Chapter 1970. Roundy. The Game. Detroit Tigers 5, Washington Senators nothing. At Robert F. Kennedy Memorial Stadium in Washington, D.C. Attendance, 45,015. It was Monday, April 6, 1970, and the weather was miserable. Temperatures in the 40s, 55-minute rain delay. Hall of Famers? Senators first base coach Nellie Fox and manager Ted Williams and Tigers right fielder Al Kaline. Game highlights. Tigers ace Mickey Lolich threw a complete game shutout. He would pitch 16 seasons in the majors, win more than 200 games, and play in 3 All-Star games. For the Senators, my childhood hero, slugger Frank Houndo Howard, collected 3 singles. But the game's real highlight came before Lolich faced his third batter and before Hondo's bat made contact with a baseball. His biggest hit of the afternoon came when 22-year-old Morgana, the kissing bandit, jumped the railing along the third baseline, ran up behind him as he headed to the batter's box, tapped him on the back, and proceeded to hug and kiss the giant twice her size. Washington Post reporter Bill Gilday asked the clearly uncomfortable Howard about the incident. Quote, "It happened so fast," he said. "It was very embarrassing to me, and I know it was embarrassing to my wife, who was in the stands. Personally, I wish it had never happened." This was one of the first, but certainly not the last, times Morgana would rush up to a pro athlete during a game. Over the next 30 years, she enhanced her career as an exotic dancer by targeting many of sport's most famous players. The story. Washington Post columnist Tom Boswell has many fond memories of baseball's opening day in the nation's capital. Quote, "Once opening day lived here," he wrote of his hometown. "It was Washington's World Series, the capital city's bonus Christmas. The presidential opener," Boswell continued, "was the dawn of the year's better half, a cherry blossom declaration of independence from winter, a springtime Bill of Rights." Since 1910, the President of the United States was almost always on hand to throw out the ceremonial first pitch from the front row of the stands. A week before opening day 1970, more than 4,000 fans spent a very chilly night in line outside Robert F. Kennedy Memorial Stadium to buy up the 20,000 remaining tickets to watch their Washington Senators, a team which the year before, under rookie manager Ted Williams, had posted a winning record for only the second time since 1945. The most powerful city in the world was well known for being first in war, first in peace, and last in the American League. In the early research for this book, I searched YouTube for Washington Senators and found a treasure. Local radio personality Ernie Kiger had preserved most of the radio broadcast of opening day 1970. The memorable long-ago voices of Shelby Whitfield and Ron Mencine on WWDC 1260 AM triggered something powerful. Memories came pouring back of a little boy with his small transistor radio tucked under his pillow way past his bedtime those summer nights. While some kids might have a stuffed animal, I had a small, black, plastic, battery-powered device that connected me in real time to heroes. It was maybe 3 inches by 3 inches and had 2 knobs, one for volume, always turned to low, and the other for tuning to the station. The biggest hero of all was Frank Houndo Howard, a gigantic outfielder who was one of the sport's most prolific home run hitters of the time. My parents took me and a few friends to one of my first Senators games for my 9th birthday on August 9th, 1969. Washington was playing the Seattle Pilots, who would later become the Milwaukee Brewers. It was also autograph day, but the line to meet Houndo was way too long. He made it up to all of us about an hour later when he crushed a second-inning pitch from Jim Boughton farther than this little boy could have imagined possible. I was hooked for life. Kiger's uploaded audio file of opening day 1970 included Whitfield describing a cool gray day here in Washington. I remembered sitting way above the third baseline and during a cold, miserable rain delay. been peering down as nine men in white uniforms and red caps ran out to play ball on the green and brown diamond that, through the mist, seemed a mile away. To this day, I can rattle off most of the lineups from Williams' years as manager in Washington from 1969 to 71. Shelby, Ron, and some newspaper headline writers occasionally refer to the Senators as the gnats. At first, I thought they were comparing them to some sort of pesky insect, the underdog that might, from time to time, beat the perennial powerhouse and American League East rival Baltimore Orioles. I later learned the official team name of the original iteration of D.C.'s American League team was changed from Senators to Nationals, Nats for short, in 1905 to appease fans of the city's 19th century National League team of the same name. But in the decades that followed, sports writers and fans just couldn't shake it and used the two names almost interchangeably. The preserved radio broadcast was an emotional goldmine. At one point, Nats center fielder Del Unser struck out. Another familiar voice in the background could be heard. It was opening day stadium announcer and legendary D.C. sports publicist Charlie Brotman. He'd been the team's promotions director and stadium announcer before the team moved to RFK in 1962 and reclaimed the microphone every opening day thereafter. He introduced the next hitter with a memorable intonation made famous by his friend and fellow stadium voice Phil Hochberg. Paul Casanova! In addition to his Senators' duties over the years, Charlie served as master of ceremonies for every presidential inaugural parade from Eisenhower through Obama, plus a cameo during Biden's virtual inaugural parade across America. I would intern and later work for Charlie from 1980 through 83. More on him in Chapter 1983. With the Tigers up 3-0 in the seventh inning, Shelby let listeners know, President Nixon, who arrived in the fifth inning, is watching the second half of this ballgame, along with the First Lady, their two daughters, son-in-law, Bowie Kuhn, the commissioner is here, along with American League President Joe Cronin, Mayor and Mrs. Walter Washington, also is in the presidential box. Clearly, this was something special. It was special to skip part of a school day to spend time with Dad. It was special because we thought the president and other important people would be there. Spending time with my father was always special, but sometimes awkward as well. We spent opening day together from 1970 through 78 and again in 1983. But if you're expecting a sappy story about a father passing along his love of the game to his son, you'll be disappointed. Dad had absolutely no interest in baseball. He started this streak and made sure it continued, but he probably could not have named more than three players from those games. He was more about big events than he was about baseball. That's an understatement. He often shared the self-deprecating story of his bizarre behavior while attending a historic World Series game before I was born. It was 1956, Game 5. New York Yankees pitcher Don Larsen would throw the only perfect game in World Series history. I have no idea why this then 41-year-old D.C. lawyer would have been at Yankee Stadium that October afternoon, but we heard the story repeated so often, it must have been reasonably true. It illustrates how absolutely clueless he was about the game of baseball. He certainly had no rooting interest in the game. Maybe Mom did. She'd relocated from her native New York to Washington in 1942 to marry Dad. As the story went, Larsen took the mound in the top of the ninth with the bottom of the Dodgers' order due up, including pitcher Sal Magley, who had no-hit the Philadelphia Phillies just 2 weeks prior. Larsen had retired all 24 Dodgers he'd faced. Perfect. So far. Now, if there's one baseball superstition every fan knows, don't talk about no-hitters while they're in progress, lest you jinx the outcome. But with two outs in the ninth and pinch hitter Dale Mitchell batting for Magley, Frank Ortman, surrounded by more than 60,000 Yankees fans, reportedly stood up and yelled, "We want a hit!" Ugh. Had to be the beer talking. Imagine the reaction of those around him had the batter broken up the perfect game. Frank would have been pummeled. But Mitchell struck out, and exuberant catcher Yogi Berra leaped into the pitcher's arms. Larson's place in baseball history was sealed, and Dad escaped unscathed from the house that Ruth built. As devoid as he was of baseball decorum, he was even more lacking in baseball skill. There was a reason he never tried to help coach my Catholic Youth Organization baseball team. We once tried to play catch in the alley behind our row house. It wasn't exactly a want-to-have-a-catch moment like that one from Field of Dreams. I used my baseball glove, of course. He used a kitchen trash can in hopes of keeping my tosses from getting by. One could only hope the neighbors weren't watching. I was very young when my parents took a few of us siblings to suburban Maryland for the Montgomery County Fair. There was the classic clown sitting over a water tank, taunting patrons who'd paid for the privilege of throwing a baseball in hopes of dunking the heckler. Not surprisingly, Dad missed the target. Noting my father's rotund physique, the clown blasted into his microphone for all to hear.
"Look at old Roundy! He couldn't hit the broadside of a barn!"
The nickname stuck. For the rest of his life, my father would be known to his kids as Roundy. Considering what he lacked in baseball knowledge and skill, I thought for the longest time that Roundy's commitment to opening day had something to do with our significant age gap. As best he could, he'd show his love by sharing something I loved, baseball. And that was part of it, but it also had to do with the magnitude of opening day. It was special. It was memorable. It was a big event. Dad had a remarkable grasp of historic moments. He wanted to be a part of them and share them with his kids, including his youngest son. In 1963, as the nation mourned the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, Dad burned this historic moment into my memory, even though I was only 3 years old. The law offices of Razor, Ortman, Barber, Welch, and Bell occupied part of a floor in a building on the corner of 17th and L Streets Northwest, just blocks from St. Matthew's Cathedral, where President Kennedy's funeral took place. On that cold November day, we stood on the corner outside his office to see the president's flag-draped, horse-drawn caisson roll by on its way to Arlington National Cemetery. In 1968, after the assassination of the president's brother, Senator Robert Kennedy, Roundy made sure we were there to pay our respects. On the day of the funeral, we stood outside Washington's Union Station to again watch a Kennedy casket en route to Arlington. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had been gunned down just weeks earlier, and racial tensions were high. Protests, riots, and curfews ruled the city. Some might have thought it dangerous to be out on the streets, and yet there we were in the shadow of the Capitol. I will forever remember the image of thousands of black men and women, young and old, covering every inch of the two-tiered fountain and surrounding area in front of the train station, prayerfully singing, "We Shall Overcome." By 1969, Dad's office had moved four blocks south to the corner of 17th and Pennsylvania Avenue, just a block from the White House. That January, Roundy made sure we were on the roof of his office building, decades before trained snipers would occupy those lofty perches. Looking down as an open-air limousine transported just-inaugurated President Nixon and his wife, Pat, to their new home. Roundy was a native Washingtonian, growing up just blocks from Griffith Stadium, then home to the Washington Senators. He went straight from St. John's College High School to the Columbus School of Law, and later served in the Army during World War II. Of his time in the service, he'd often say, "I went in a single private and came out a married major with two children. It was a hell of a war." I was the youngest of six children. Dad was 45 when I was born. His only athletic accomplishments were played out on the golf course. A four-year high school letterman, he scored his only hole-in-one on the day he graduated in June 1933. Coincidentally, 4 months later, Washington would make its last trip to the World Series until the Nationals won it all in 2019. That first iteration of the Senators left to become the Minnesota Twins after the 1960 season, but was quickly replaced with another equally dreadful expansion team of the same name. It did not matter that the Senators were consistently bad. opening day in Washington was a national major event. Roundy's kind of thing. For box scores, play-by-play, and more, visit openingday50.com.